This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We're going to start the program today by bringing you up to speed with the latest in Germany's effort to form a government. A very interesting development last Friday as leaders from the main political parties forged an agreement that could help coalition talks going forward. What's interesting here isn't so much that there's a path to forging a government. It's looking at the issues that they're focusing on in order to move Germany forward. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about this and get some insight into the mindset of Germany's leaders, particularly regarding the future of the European Union. It's actually quite relevant to the fulfillment of biblical prophecy. In our second segment, we're going to talk about a rapidly growing religious movement. It's a Mexican folk religion that celebrates death, and thanks to the influx of drug cartels, it's spreading into the United States. We'll talk with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about why we should be aware of this religion called Santa Muerte. Recently, some executives of social media companies have come out with very condemning interviews telling us that we need to beware how we are using these online tools. A lot of us have come to these conclusions on our own, but it's quite extraordinary to hear these people talking about it. We'll talk with Trumpet writer Kieran Underwood about what they're saying, listen to a couple of clips from these folks, and we'll talk about how to reclaim our ability to think and relate to the people around us. And we'll conclude by talking about how to mine the gold nuggets out of the biblical book of Proverbs. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Germany has been without a government since its election in September, but last Friday, after a marathon 26-hour negotiation, German leaders declared that they'd made a breakthrough in forming a coalition. Is this a cause for optimism for Germany? Trumpet writer Richard Palmer says that the text of this agreement could have major ramifications for the European Union. He wrote in an article this week, it could see Angela Merkel strong-arming Eastern Europe into accepting thousands of migrants and strong-arming Germany into a much more powerful role in Europe. Pretty strong charges here. We have him via Skype from England to talk about this. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So if you could just briefly bring our listeners up to speed with the situation that Germany is finding itself in here.
So Germany had their election September 24th. It was a very awkward result. None of the obvious coalitions were going to work. So thus far, Germany has had its longest time ever, at least in post-war history, without a government. Angela Merkel tried one route with a very cumbersome coalition that involved trying to get the environmentalist Greens to work together with the pro-business Free Democrats. That all fell apart. So now she's turned to the Social Democrats, the main left-wing party. And initially, they did not want to do any kind of deal with Angela Merkel. They had their worst. They were in a coalition with Angela Merkel the year before, and then they suffered, before the election, and then they suffered their worst election defeat in post-war history. So they weren't keen at all to go back to the same situation. But after the other deals fell apart, after it looked like there were no really good options for Germany, rather than having another set of elections where they could presumably still do really badly, they decided, okay, well, we'll at least look into doing a coalition with you.
Oh, so tell us the substance of what they agreed to last Friday then.
So what they agreed to on Friday is basically a roadmap for oncoming coalition negotiations. The broad outline. So, okay, this is in general what we want to achieve. We're going to spend the next few weeks working out on, say, the details and the specifics, but this is the kind of the vision. This is the overall picture of what we want the next government to be like.
So it's nothing detailed has been worked out to this point. This is like the precondition talks for the pre-talks that would lead to a coalition down the road.
Yes, that's right. There are things that I guess have been ruled out at this point. So certain coalition or election promises have been not put into the coalition agreement. So you can see some where some specifics aren't happening. But basically, their best case scenario is they're aiming to get all of these final discussions done by April 1st. that really is a best case scenario, though. A lot of people in the Social Democrats do not like this deal. The leader of the youth wing is actually traveling around Germany, actively campaigning against it. There have been several key leaders saying, we don't like this deal. We don't want to be in coalition with Angela Merkel. And the party is going to have to approve it. Both the just even for this to continue, the kind of the party delegates, 600 senior party delegates have to approve it. At the end of the day, party rank and file members have to give their final approval to the final document. So not the document we have yet, but the one that does have all the details in it. They have to give their final yes or no. And at the moment, 49% say, or 49.5% of the rank and file say they don't look favorably on a coalition, with only about 42% saying that they do. So it's not looking good. And just even, you know, we had the Trumpet brief that went out last night. And even since then, there's just been more bad news and more negativity coming from the Social Democrats. So it's now even an open question as to whether what they agreed on will last the week.
So there certainly are some formidable hurdles here if this is going to actually produce a successful government. And the earliest that would happen would be at the beginning of April, presumably. But what you say in this article is that what they actually agreed to does give us some insight into what's going on in the minds of these leaders. Maybe we could preface that way. You could just tell us where we would be, assuming they were able to actually surmount all of these obstacles and end up with a government. Does that mean Germany is a functional country leading Europe strongly again?
It means no, not really. It still means that there's a coalition that is fatally crippled. You know, a coalition of the walking wounded. I like the way that Spiegel put it. They called this proposed coalition a paleo coalition, a coalition of political dinosaurs and has-beens. I mean, maybe they'll address that when they come to putting the cabinet together. It's also been called a coalition of losers, because it's basically cobbled together by two parties that did badly last election. I mean, some people, yeah, they do kind of take the view, well, it will be business as usual. Angela Merkel ruled with coalition with the Social Democrats before, and it was fairly stable. She can do so again. But there are big, big differences this time. Not the least of the fact that before the election, these two parties had a coalition in which they controlled 80% of the seats in the German parliament. This time, they control 56%. Big difference. You know, last time, it would take a massive rebellion, you know, epic rebellion, most of one of the parties rebelling to derail any of the any specific government policies. When your majority is 56%, you know, you only need that 6% to turn against you and you've lost your majority.
Yeah.
So much, you know, rebels are going to play a much bigger impact. Then again, everybody's looking at this disastrous election that they've just had. The Social Democrats knowing, okay, we came off our worst election in our post-war history. We need to do better next time. We need to make it more obvious that we're playing, that we're making a difference. We need to get rid of this perception that you vote for the Social Democrats and you get Angela Merkel. We have to be showing that we're making a difference in what Angela Merkel wants to do. That means being a difficult coalition partner. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, Angela Merkel's wounded. And, you know, in politics, if there's a wounded politician, the shark starts smelling blood. People start plotting. People start working out, well, who can be the first person to unseat them, get their job. So you're going to have much more ambitious people looking to try and come in as well. So there's a lot of things going against, even if this is agreed, this being a stable coalition.
Best case scenario under the current plan is they end up with a very weak government of the walking wounded and all of that.
Exactly.
Nevertheless, you just to return to this idea that we actually do kind of get some insight into what these leaders are thinking by looking at what was agreed to here. Maybe you can just explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, this is fascinating. You get firstly some of what they aim to do if they're in government. But even if this never works out, you get insight to what are the top priorities of Germany's biggest parties. Mm-hmm. And it is fascinating. You look at, say, the last coalition deal in 2013, didn't really talk much about Europe. You know, kind of the general, you know, we believe in a European Union, but not much at all. This time, Europe is the number one article. I think it's about a 12-page document, and the first three pages are about Europe. So this is they're making a big statement. You know, right at the top of our agenda is European reform. And I wrote this last night. Then I saw this morning an article in the Financial Times by Gideon Rachman, and he said that if this does come together, it would be truly radical in one respect. The section on the future of the EU lays out the biggest push by Germany towards continental integration since the Maastricht Treaty a quarter of a century ago. So it's a major push for European unity.
And that's really the – you say it's the number one thing. It takes up a quarter of the document. What sort of reforms do they want in order to further integrate Europe?
Well, if you think about the European Union – historically, being sold to voters, this is a free trade agreement. You know, it's just to help us trade together. And okay, we'll introduce a few regulations about, say, lawnmowers, so that we all have the same lawnmower regulations, so it makes it easier for us to sell lawnmowers and wine and cheese to each other. But at the end of the day, this is about free trade. This, what the German government are calling for, completely demolishes that, way beyond anything that could be remotely justified as just a free trade agreement. So they're talking about standardizing things like minimum wage all the way across the European Union. They're talking about harmonizing social security laws, social security protection. So they don't spell out specifics, but for example, that is in theory things like common pension ages, pension systems, retirement funds. So very specific things that's normally taken on by governments. They're talking about changing the European Stability Mechanism, which is what they kind of put together to bail out European countries that got into trouble, into a European monetary fund, something much more permanent and something that has much more political clout. They're talking about making changes so that rather than Europe operating as, say, you vote for your country's prime minister and he negotiates with other prime ministers, they're trying to make it more like you vote, like operating as one country. You know, people all the way across Europe voting for representatives that then go and take on various responsibilities. So these are huge steps towards a super state. But the one that really jumps out to me is their talk about tying together the money that the European Union hands out with what they call solidarity. So linking that every nation in the EU pays quite a significant sum of money to the European Union, and they get that money, some of that money at least, back. Rich countries get less back than they pay in. Poor countries get more back than they pay in. And what they're talking about doing is saying that countries that don't embrace European solidarity would have that money cut off. When you get rid of some of these nice soft, you know, solidarity, as even the EU Observer put it, is a code word for accepting migrants. It's we, the Central Europe or the main big European powers, this is what we want you to do. If you don't do this, your money is cut. That type of muscle is something we've never seen from the European Union before. They did some of this to a certain extent after the Greek crisis, where they introduced the ability to put sanctions on countries that had unbalanced budgets and this kind of thing. That then was a huge step, but it wasn't really enforced or put into practice all that much. But now they're talking about blackmailing countries in things that directly relate to national sovereignty. Is there anything more fundamental to being a nation than deciding who you let in and who you don't let in? And regardless of your belief on migrants, on whether, say, Poland should take in more migrants or less migrants, if you are a democratic state, that is something that belongs to the voters. And in Eastern Europe, the voters have made their beliefs on those issues incredibly clear, voting through anti-immigration parties all across the board. You know, we don't want more immigration. And what Germany's looking at putting in place is, well, you say that, but OK, we're going to fine you. We're going to cut off your money. We're going to take billions away from you unless you do what we want. We want to be able to override Polish voters, Czech Republic voters. And that's a major step towards a super state. And it's a major step towards Germany, to a lesser extent, France, Italy, Spain, some of these other big nations with lots of voting rights. But a major step to these nations having control of the European Union, being able to boss other nations around, turning the European Union. I mean, it's already kind of a a covert, say, or I mean, covert's too strong of a word. It's not exactly secret, but we'll stick with it for now. It's already kind of a covert vehicle for German dominance of Europe. This makes it much more public, much more overt, much more official.
This is really quite extraordinary. When we saw the election results in September, and we were talking about how well far-right parties in the European or in Germany did in that election, and we saw this as we see this trend in several European countries that there is a strong anti-immigrant sentiment among European voters. There's a strong anti-EU, strong anti-bureaucracy sentiment among European voters. And we were talking about how Merkel was going to have to accommodate the fact of the shift in the German electorate at that time. This is amazing, just 3 months down the track, for her to be in these coalition negotiations where essentially they're doubling down on some of the very policies that created the friction with such a huge portion of the electorate. What do you make of that?
It is interesting, especially at the EU level. I mean, if you talk about, say, at the domestic level, she is doing some things to make concessions to those anti-immigrant voters. So, for example, the coalition the deal outline calls for a cap on 220,000 migrants a year. Now, there's no way of enforcing that cap. It's a number written on a piece of paper, and they haven't said they're going to stop migrants if they go over that cap. So it is completely meaningless. They also limited the number of family members that can join refugees that are already in Germany to just 1,000 a month. That's something that's more practical. So I think there's some window dressing to try and appeal to those voters within Germany. I think they'll see through it, but it's an attempt at least. But this point on the European level, you're right. It's doubling down on everything that makes Europe unpopular. Jean-Claude Juncker was going, I think it was Bulgaria. I'm not completely certain exactly where it was last week. And they were burning EU flags out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because of this. It's this kind of thing. It was in a lot of ways, it was migration, not Eastern European. I mean, not Muslim migration, but Eastern European migration. But it was migration was the big issue one of the big issues that pushed Britain to leave the European Union. So it is a doubling down on an incredibly unpopular aspect of Europe. And it's something, like I was saying, it could lead to more German control of the European Union. It could also just lead for this whole thing to explode. I mean, bring about some kind of crisis where the whole thing falls apart. I mean, either way, if they can push this through, it's a big moment for Europe. But yeah, Eastern European nations are going to fight that kind of proposal like crazy.
Well, I guess just looking at it, say, within Germany, it seems like these politicians must have some sense that there is an appetite within their constituencies that they want more Germany within Europe. They want a stronger European project with Germany at the helm. We don't talk about that as much because you don't see people, say, demonstrating on the streets for more Europe and that type of thing. But there must be that kind of sentiment within the Germans. And you almost see there's a certain amount of loggerheads here when you have the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland party, that has more openly anti-immigrant, anti-EU policies. It's like they're both looking at the problems that are facing Germany and the EU more broadly, and they're coming up with different solutions to how we can make this work.
Right. And I think in Germany, I mean, there's two strong desires within Germany when it comes to Europe. I think one is, you're right, there is quite a strong desire for more Europe. And the other is they don't want German money to pay for it.
Right.
That is what got the AfD started in the first place. Before migrants, it was German money going to Greece, and it was a party led by a bunch of economists. So you've got those twin desires, and what that leads to is this push to a Germany that dominates Europe, because the only way for Germany to make sure that a strong Europe doesn't become a way for Southern European countries to vote themselves access to German money mm-hmm. is if they dominate the whole thing. So I do think, you know, if you go and if you ask, say, the average German, do you want to dominate Europe? You'd say, of course not. No, we want it to be Democrat. But it's because they want to make sure that their money is safe. And I think it's that you put those two together, and that's leading to this push for a Germany that really does dominate it from whether as far as the public are concerned.
That's a really fascinating way to put it, especially in light of what we've talked about, the interview that you all did with Nicholas Frank, and just some of the material that we've put out there about the German, the average German person, and just how, you know, when they're backed into a corner, when they're pushed against a wall, how do they respond to that? And there is a certain volatility here within the German electorate that you do just wonder what the next step is going to be. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about putting this into prophetic context for us, why it's so important that we watch this, and why really the Trumpet's eyes are glued to what's happening here.
Well, we've talked for years about Germany dominating the European Union. I think I was making this point on Friday, that you go back to the very day after Victory in Europe Day in World War II, and Herbert W. Armstrong was saying, watch for Germany to dominate Europe. You know, that's there. That's happened. That's, you know, we've talked for years ago. It was 3-4 years ago. Spiegel had their big headline, the Fourth Reich is here, at least in an economic sense. Germany dominates Europe. That part of what we've been watching for is in place. But we've always said that then it will be led by a German strongman. So that's what we're watching for now, this next chapter. And that's something that would just be transformative for the European Union. It has so many of these different aspects of power, the nuts and bolts of power, you know, the economy, the geography, the resources, to be a very powerful nation. And the biggest thing it lacks is leadership. And so as you see a leadership crisis in Germany, as you see the potential for that kind of leadership crisis to spread across to the rest of the European Union, well, that's creating the perfect conditions for this strong German leader to emerge out of. And it's creating the exact conditions that the Bible prophesied of this strong German leader emerging out of. And even Jesus Christ himself in Matthew 24, he alluded to some of these prophecies about what is coming to Germany. So it's because of those very specific prophecies, so much of which has already happened and already come true, that we're watching this so closely. It is something we have a trend section on our website. The trend is a strong man of Germany to lead Europe. The country is called, the article is called Why the Trumpet Watches the Rise of a German Strongman. And that just goes through step by step these prophecies that inform our watching of this aspect of German and European politics.
Excellent. We appreciate that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer. He's actually written this article that appeared on the website on Monday. It's called Germany's Coalition of Losers. You can check that out on thetrumpet.com. That other article that he just mentioned, Why the Trumpet Watches the Rise of a German Strongman, you can find that under the trends section. Excellent stuff. Thank you very much, Richard.
Thanks. It's been a real pleasure.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
You know what the fastest growing religious movement in the Western Hemisphere is? It isn't some form of evangelicalism. It isn't Islam. It's actually a Mexican folk religion devoted to worshiping Nuestra Señora de la Santa Muerte, Our Lady of the Holy Death. It has an estimated 10 to 12 million adherents, mostly in Mexico. And thanks to the infiltration of drug cartels into the United States, it's growing here as well. To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Andrew Miller here in the studio. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
So tell us about this religion.
Yeah, it's a very ancient religion that's only made a comeback recently. It's based off all the way back to like pre-Columbian Aztec times, when the Aztec people would pray to their goddess of the underworld. But when Catholic missionaries first started coming to Mexico, they started trying to evangelize the local population, they likened this Aztec death goddess to the Grim Reaper back in Europe. And then kind of in the folk populations, that kind of these two figures got merged, and then they even put in elements of the Virgin Mary from Catholicism into this to come up with this new holy death figure that originally was popular right in the decades after the Spanish conquest, but obviously the Catholic Church and the Mexican government weren't too thrilled about people praying to death and getting involved in occult rites. And so it was widely thought to have died out, almost died out, by the year 2000, about 18 years ago. But since then, it's made a stunning and shocking resurgence, like you said, with going from almost non-existent to up to 10 to 12 million people. Like I said, mostly in Mexico, but spreading into the United States, partially due to drug cartels and illegal immigrants, and partially due to just like social media campaigns with young people who may be involved in drugs who think this is cool. When I lived in Texas for a good long time, you definitely see the bumper stickers and the figurines and shop windows that this is in the Houston area, Houston, San Antonio area, that this is something that's really catching on.
So what do you make of this? Is this it seems like the first of all, it's spreading among a very violent group, the drug cartels that are attracted to this, and they're celebrating death, they're worshiping death in the way that you're describing. That's kind of the nucleus of it, but it also seems like they're taking advantage of a certain void spiritually among a segment of the people who are coming into contact with this.
Right. Well, and especially in Mexico, amongst a lot of the people kind of on what you'd call like the outskirts of society, the drug traffickers, the drug addicts, the transgenders, the homosexuals, the people who aren't following Christian principles or even Catholic principles through here, there's a strong pull to a folk goddess like this Holy Death, just due to the fact that they don't operate on a blessings for obedience, cursings for disobedience principle. It's more like a trade system. You offer them some sort of offering. In some cases, it gets as extreme as human sacrifices. Another thing, it's just like a pledge or a deal you try to make with this deity in return for something back, which is... So it's mostly being driven by people who don't want to follow biblical principles but still want to get something in return. It's even for like folk Catholics in Mexico who would pray to the Virgin Mary or pray to the Saint Jude, who's the Catholic saint for like the dispossessed. It's still hard to pray to even a figure like that to get your crystal meth shipment to show up on time or to ask that your rival gang will be killed or vanquished. It's much easier to go back to the old Aztec gods and ask for something like that. And
right.
So you see, I think just a few years ago, they had like a drug cartel in Mexico raid a prison and kill 28 people. And it's not a strange thing for a drug cartel to raid a prison and kill people. That's pretty typical behavior for drug cartels. But what was more concerning is they killed him in a ritual sacrifice in front of a shrine to this skeletal saint.
So this is the type of influence that we're seeing, the spread of... how common is this? You're talking about sacrifices. What are the other elements of this religion that are making their way into society because of the spread of the religion?
Right. Well, and it's... like I said, the sacrifices are something. In the United States, there's been 4 confirmed ritual sacrifices that the FBI has recognized. But it's also very hard to separate sometimes the religious aspect of something like this with just more the logistic aspects of drug trafficking or the people who are getting involved in this type of worship.
So it's basically taking the dangers of the drug cartels spreading influence in the United States, and it's adding this kind of religious dimension to it.
Yeah, or even adding a moral veneer, I guess, if you're into a drug trafficking and you want to feel good about yourself. Now you've got this own basically worshiping death, your own goddess, that you're not in a moral violation to kill 28 people. As a matter of fact, you're doing her a favor. and especially get some of like these Aztec religions where this is based off an Aztec underworld goddess that if they demand blood, it's almost like a barter system where like, well, if I'll give you someone else's, you don't have to take mine. And so it's kind of a way that they try to, at least in their belief system, this is a way you can preserve their life. You offer a sacrifice of maybe blood, maybe drugs, maybe money, whatever. And then in return, you're expecting that you'll get protection from this deity against rival gangs or from the police or from society or whatever. There's a big spectrum of different beliefs ranging all the way from human sacrifice to just being illegal immigrants on the run from the law who are just looking for protection from like immigration agents or something like that. But
so in Europe, they're dealing with, say, the religious dimension to the immigration problem that they're experiencing over there. They're pointing to the fact that so many of them are Muslims who have been radicalized, who are interested in spreading terror. And this is one of the reasons why there's such concern over immigration there. It, to this point in America, the argument against, say, a religious dimension to the immigration problem has been there are far fewer people who are making the argument that there's a religious problem here by allowing illegal immigration. And yet here's an example where there is actually a religious dimension to it, and you could dismiss it, but looking at the numbers, 10 to 12 million people in Mexico, and even if it's a small influence to this point, there's still something to be concerned about here in this spreading in the United States.
Right, because you're looking at illegal immigration, and probably 90% of illegal immigrants are Roman Catholic. But there is definitely this this undercurrent that comes in here that does have a very concerning religious dimension. I'm working on a article to go up on thetrumpet.com hopefully later this week where I bring out a case that happened over late December where they had an 18-year-old from Honduras in America illegally shot to death in front of an apartment building in Maryland. And when they looked into the case, they found out that this immigrant, they'd been arrested in October for burglary, but because they were in a sanctuary zone, they let them go on $100 bail and found that he'd been living in a house with three members of the MS-13 street gang. And the house had a shrine to this this Mexican folk death saint in it. And so there's a case that this is at least four people from, actually not even Mexico, but from Honduras, who came here illegally, joined what's probably the most violent street gang in the United States, and we're praying to this this death saint. Mm.
So just looking at this from a prophetic standpoint, or you know, how is it that we're, why are we focused on this? Why would this be important for our listeners to be concerned about?
Right, well, in the last edition of our print edition of the Philadelphia Trumpet magazine, I'd written an article called America's Retreat from Global Leadership. And that's just more explaining prophecies in Micah about how in the end time, the end time descendants of Israel, which the article shows is the United States, at the zenith of their power would lose it. They'd be thrown down. God said he'd cast down their strongholds and bring them to ruin in order to purge sins from the land, like witchcraft. And in that word witchcraft there, it's in the context of pretty much any pagan religious practice or even shallow religion and things that go against God's law. But it also refers to literal witchcraft. And it shows that something like this, I mean, you can, it is definitely the spread of this Mexican folk saint religion. It's partially due to illegal immigration and letting pagan religious practices of other peoples into this country. But it's enabled by the fact that there's not a strong, pure religious sentiment within the United States. I mean, if people were following the Ten Commandments as a whole and families were strong, you wouldn't have the young people who are driven into drug addiction and then driven from drug addiction into crime and then getting on the wrong side of the law and feeling like you have no place to turn until you start worshiping a Mexican death saint who will allegedly help you in return for giving her drugs or giving her money or giving her another person's life.
Yeah.
And so this is probably kind of like the extreme vanguard example of where a life living apart from God's law can lead step by step. But it is a vanguard example of a much bigger spiritual sickness in America.
Right. Yeah, it makes me think, too, just about how it does seem like more and more you see these stories that are just showing this evil spiritual influence and demonic type activity that are spreading in the world today, where we're not vigilant against this like we should be. I think a lot of people would be very dismissive of it, and yet you see headlines about these types of things cropping up with increasing frequency. And it really is something that we should be aware of and be vigilant to, not something that we should just dismiss casually. But anything that you would point people to for, say, more information about this?
Well, I think the best resource you could go to for just explaining the spiritual or demonic dimension behind this attack on America is Pastor General Gerald Flory's book, America Under Attack. We have a booklet called, also by Mr. Gerald Flory, called No Freedom Without Law, that does explain that things like drug addiction or alcoholism, pornography, things like this, that there people tout these things as being a road to freedom, having the freedom to do these things, but it does enslave your mind to this spiritual dimension.
All right, well, we appreciate that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about this Mexican folk religion called Santa Muerte that's actually spreading within the United States. He's working on an article on the subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate your time, Andrew.
Thank you.
Is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Social media is everywhere. Facebook, Twitter, so many different kinds of social media outlets out there, and it's absorbing a huge amount of people's time. Recently, interestingly, several high-profile creators of these popular applications have said that these social media platforms are destroying us, and we need to get away from them. To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Kieran Underwood. Hello, Kieran.
Hello. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah. So let's talk about what these men are saying. The first, we're going to play a couple of clips here. The first was given by Sean Parker to Axios. This is a man who, the first president of Facebook, he co-founded Napster. This man has a net worth of $2.6 billion. And this is what he told the reporter at Axios.
When Facebook was getting going, I had these people who would come up to me and they would say, you know, I'm not on social media. And I would say, okay, you know, you will be. And then they would say, no, I value my real life interactions, I value the moment, I value presence, and I value intimacy. And I would say, well, you're a conscientious objector, that's okay. You don't have to participate, but you know, we'll get you eventually. and like, I don't know if I really understood the consequences of what I was saying. Because the unintended consequences of a network when it grows to a billion or 2 billion people, and it literally changes your relationship with society, with each other, with it probably interferes with productivity in weird ways. It, God only knows what it's doing to our children's brains. You know, if the thought process that went into building these applications, Facebook being the first of them to really understand it. That thought process was all about how do we consume as much of your time and conscious attention as possible. And that means that we need to sort of give you a little dopamine hit every once in a while because someone liked or commented on a photo or a post or whatever. And that's going to get you to contribute more content, and that's going to get you, you know, more likes and comments. I mean, it's a social validation feedback loop that it's like a, I mean, it's exactly the kind of thing that a hacker like myself would come up with, because you're exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology. And I think that the inventors, creators, you know, and it's me, it's Mark, it's the, you know, Kevin Systrom at Instagram, it's all of these people, understood this consciously, and we did it anyway.
Yeah, so we'll stop there for a bit and talk about this. What he said was very interesting. I think this social validation feedback loop, basically saying, you know, the dopamine hit that you get from these things, that they knew that they were exploiting this vulnerability in human psychology.
So it would keep you on.
Yeah. It just reminded me of an outline from the Worldwide Church of God. I think it was an organizational, like personal organization lecture that they put out. And it was talking about how basically Satan uses this. He's created this world in a way that is intended to maximize how much of our lives
to take up as much as possible.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's just really quite extraordinary to hear a guy come out and talking about it at that level.
Yeah. And you see this all the time. People will invent something and they can see the psychology behind it, and they don't really know what's going to come out at the end. They say, we'll build this tool anyway. We'll build Facebook. And then 10 years later or so, they come out with the research. They find out, oh, this is bad for us. Too late, though. We've already built it, and 2 billion people are already using it.
The law of unintended consequences.
Right.
Yeah, that seems to be the case with just about anything that human beings build, that they build it and then they think about the consequences. They think about what's going to happen after you're already dealing with them, rather than foreseeing those before they put them into action.
Exactly right.
Well, let's listen to this second interview snippet. This is from Chamath Palihapitiya, Stanford Graduate School of Business. He gave this in November. He's a Facebook executive, and this is what he said about Facebook.
To the point that you were making about exploiting consumer behavior in a consumer internet business, you said that this is a time for soul searching in social media businesses, and you were part of building the largest one. What soul searching are you doing right now on that?
I feel tremendous guilt. I think we all knew in the back of our minds, even though we feigned this whole line of like, there probably aren't any really bad unintended consequences, I think in the back, deep, deep recesses of our minds, we kind of knew something bad could happen. But I think the way we defined it was not like this. It literally is a point now where I think we have created tools that are ripping apart the social fabric of how society works. That is truly where we are. And I would encourage all of you, as the future leaders of the world, to really internalize how important this is. If you feed the beast, that beast will destroy you. If you push back on it, we have a chance to control it and rein it in. And it is a point in time where people need to hard break from some of these tools and the things that you rely on. The short-term dopamine-driven feedback loops that we have created are destroying how society works. No civil discourse, no cooperation, misinformation, mistruth. And it's not an American problem. This is not about Russian ads. This is a global problem. So we are in a really bad state of affairs right now, in my opinion. It is It is eroding the core foundations of how people behave by and between each other.
Yeah. You have any thoughts?
Yeah, well, I think it's really interesting what he talked about, that it's not just a localized problem. You know, he talked about, oh, it's not Russian ads. It's not just an American problem. It really is something that spans everyone, considering there's 2 billion people who are using it out of, say, 7 billion people on the planet. It's not an American problem. It's a problem everywhere. And I think later on he even talks about why he decided to not use Facebook. He talks about this later in the interview, and he says, I just decided to not use it because I instinctively knew I didn't want to get programmed. Mm-hmm. He talks about how Facebook is designed for you to get the news that you already have searched for. So if you're only subscribing to, say, conservative news, or if you're only subscribing to liberal news, then you're going to get that again and again and again.
Yeah, essentially reinforcing the view that you already have. And he called it programming, which is an interesting word to use in light of the fact that some of these applications have actually been shown to have a certain bias, that they're actually filtering certain news out, and it's reinforcing this view, this pretty toxic view of the world that a lot of people have, in ways that really do damage us.
Right.
Yeah, the fact that he has pulled out, that he said, he basically, I think he said he's only posted maybe,
twice,
you know,
in 10
the last 7 years or something, that he doesn't use these tools. It reminds me of Steve Jobs saying, like, he wouldn't allow his children to use an iPad or to use some of these technologies.
And Bill Gates would do the same thing with his children.
So what does that tell you, these folks are, they're marketing these things and they're creating enormously successful companies. Mark Zuckerberg, he actually said that he's going to try to fix Facebook this year. And as soon as he started talking about what that was going to involve, like basically limiting news in people's Facebook feeds and having them more just talking among their family and those things where we're, he's trying to facilitate interpersonal relationships and so on, the stock dropped like dramatically. These people basically said, if the CEO of this company, if the maker of Facebook says that he's not as interested in just monopolizing people's time, then this becomes a less economically valuable company all of a sudden.
Right. I think it's interesting that I read another article where Facebook was presented this study where it showed them that people who used Facebook after a certain amount of time came out feeling less happy. Mm-hmm. And their solution to that was to stop just viewing Facebook and instead to spend more time on Facebook posting and creating content. So the solution to unhappiness if you're on Facebook is, according to them, to go out and to use Facebook more.
Right, just in a slightly different way.
Right.
I think the point that you make in your article about this, and Kieran just wrote a little blog post about this, the title of it on thetrumpet.com is What Ex-Facebook Employees Are Saying About Facebook. But just the fact that you contrast the effect that these applications are having on the way that people think with what the Bible says about how we're to use our minds. You quote some verses here that say, make sure that you redeem the time because the days are evil. This is what God says, give careful thought to your ways. Moses wrote in Psalm 90, so teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts to wisdom. There's a time management aspect of it, but there's also the fact that we need to think deeply about things, and there's a lot of evidence out there that shows that this handicaps our ability to think about things.
Yeah, I did, even in that article, I did actually reference an article that you had written, I think many years ago, on how to think deeply, and that had just a lot of great things about pulling out books, meditating, all these different things. So I try to reference a couple of those. There was another one by Mr. Brad McDonald, who's another trumpet writer, an article called Find Solitude in This Crazy World. And I remember one thing he said in that article was, if you have a phone in your pocket, you are not alone. Mm-hmm. So you can be standing in a line, you could be standing you could be sitting in your room by yourself, but just by having that phone in your pocket, you have access to thousands and thousands of people or thousands of different or apps. And there's not a way anymore that people can just have solitude if their phone is in their pocket.
Right. Yeah, I find, I think my personal Twitter account, that was really the only one that I ever used personally. There was a point where I just thought I'm tired of spending time on creating tweets and things, and just stopped doing that. But there is this sort of push and pull between wanting to get a message out to as many people as you can. But you do find that just as noisy as the world is, it is very difficult to cut through the noise and to reach an audience out there. There are a whole lot of things commanding their attention and demanding their time. So it can be very difficult to be heard.
Yeah. I think another thing that Chamath said earlier in that interview was that people needed to hard break some of these devices or some of these applications. And what he means with hard break there is literally like an alcoholic mm-hmm. hard breaking off wine, just to quit completely, just to see what it feels like to not actually be on those things throughout your day.
Right. Good to evaluate ourselves and our own use of these tools, and just evaluate our own time management. This is just a little article that we've been talking with trumpet writer Kieran Underwood about. He wrote What Ex-Facebook Employees Are Saying About Facebook. And you can find that on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate your time, Kieran.
Thanks very much.
It's time for today's last word.
When I was a teenager, I was advised to go through one chapter of Proverbs each day. Since there are 31 chapters, it's easy to get through the whole book in a month. And I did that with my Revised Standard Version. It has easier to understand language than the King James Version, and I really enjoyed that exercise. I recommend you do the same thing a few times in order to familiarize yourself with all of these surprisingly specific and amazingly relevant bits of advice in this ancient book of wisdom. As I've gotten older, though, I've come to see the benefit in slowing down. If you read 25 to 35 verses of Proverbs in one 10 to 15 minute session, you're going to spend very little time on each one. They won't make a real deep impression on your mind. But when you slow down and you spend more time on each proverb, you'll be amazed at how much more depth you find. Try this. Read Proverbs until you find one that stands out to you, and then spend 10 or 15 minutes just thinking about that one proverb. Ask yourself how it applies to your life, and write down in your own words relevant conclusions that you can draw from what that proverb is saying. I'll give you a few examples from my own journal, just looking at a few verses from Proverbs 17. Verse 1 says, "Better is a dry morsel and quietness therewith than a house full of sacrifices with strife." Thinking about that verse for a while, this is what I wrote in my journal. "Family harmony is more valuable than family prosperity. Contention in a home undermines other blessings. Whatever other blessings you have, they don't amount to much if you're fighting with each other. A family is rich if its members live in unity. Harmony makes a poor family rich. Strife makes a rich family poor." You can get a lot of pleasure just from reading the proverb and thinking about it. You might drill deeper by reading the same verse in other translations. The King James Version is usually clear, but you can also try the Revised Standard, the English Standard Version, the Moffat Translation, even the Amplified Bible. Read, think, and write. Verse 2 of Proverbs 17 says, "A wise servant shall have rule over a son that causes shame, and shall have part of the inheritance among the brethren." From my journal, "God esteems character over heredity. The conduct of your life is more important than the privilege of your birth. With God, your inheritance is based on your actions, not your ancestry. The roles of the servant and the ruler can change based on their choices. Foolishness can make a prince into a servant. Wisdom can make a servant into a prince." So if you really think about what that verse is saying, Proverbs 17, verse 2, it'll teach you a lot about God and the way he thinks. Let's look at verse 5. It says, "Whoso mocks the poor reproaches his maker, and he that is glad at calamities shall not be unpunished." This is what I wrote down after reading that verse. God hates haughtiness and arrogance. He hates a man looking down on another man. Mocking a person is mocking the God who made him. God takes it personally. He feels a sense of protectiveness toward the poor and the downtrodden. Never lose this perspective in dealing with fellow man. Each individual has a creator to whom you are accountable. God wants to build within each of us the same concern and compassion that he has. When seeing someone down, the proper response is never gladness, but compassion. "I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked," God says, "nor in their poverty, nor their calamity. A man of character may fall into poverty. Righteous people suffer trials, but the man who mocks him or is glad is a sinner, thinking like the accuser of the brethren, and he'll be judged for it. His guilt is absolute, his punishment assured." That proverb, verse 5 of chapter 17, it reveals a lot about the love of God. And it's just one of over 900 verses in the book. And they're all filled with nuggets of spiritual understanding that are worth setting your mind on and making your own. God wants to supply you wonderful understanding and guidance and wisdom. He is crying out to give it to you. He's spread it out before you in the book of Proverbs. It's up to you to take it. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. You can send your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests on the program today, Richard Palmer, Andrew Miller, and Kieran Underwood. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Frederick William Robertson. "As the tree is fertilized by its own broken branches and fallen leaves and grows out of its own decay, so men and nations are bettered and improved by trial and refined out of broken hopes and blighted expectations." Thank you for joining us on today's Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.